It is Friday, October the 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, the latest on confirming a new U.S. High Court justice and U.S. charging Russian spies.
The indictment alleges that seven Russian military intelligence officers engaged in a multi-year conspiracy to hack.
We'll learn about a symbolic victory for Iran.
They were trying to demonstrate yet again that when it comes to international law, that they have the upper hand in the argument.
Also ahead, refugee protection, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Both sides in the debate over U.S. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh are holding their ground for release of a report on an FBI investigation into allegations of his sexual misconduct. That story now from AP's Ed Donahue.
Republicans like Utah's Orrin Hatch say the report shows no hint of misconduct by Brett Kavanaugh.
It's time to end the charade.
The FBI investigation looked into allegations of sexual misconduct. Virginia Democrat Tim Kaine says it didn't go far enough.
I'm not allowed to discuss it. The public can't see it. It's a complete sham.
Protesters were arrested at a Senate office building, including comedian Amy Schumer.
They cannot keep us down. We will win.
Orrin Hatch says the Senate can't turn away Brett Kavanaugh.
He is going to be a great justice, perhaps one of the greatest we've ever had.
Ed Donahue, Washington.
Also in the news, the U.S. Justice Department has announced criminal charges against seven Russian intelligence officers in connection with attempting to penetrate the computer networks of anti-doping officials and organizations investigating Russia's use of chemical weapons. Dutch officials announced earlier that they had expelled four Russian intelligence officers after catching them with spy equipment near the chemical weapons watchdog Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. U.S. Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General John Demers, who announced the charges, said the Russians belonged to the GRU, that's Russia's military intelligence organization.
Our indictment today charges some of the same Russian operatives caught in The Hague, along with their colleagues in Moscow, as part of a conspiracy to hack a variety of individuals and organizations in the United States, Canada, and Europe to obtain information or access that was then exploited for the benefit of the Russian government. More specifically, this indictment alleges a conspiracy to use computer hacking to obtain non-public personal health information about athletes and others in the files of anti-doping agencies and sporting federations in multiple countries, and to release that stolen information selectively and sometimes misleadingly.
U.S. The VOA Justice Correspondent Masood Farivar spoke with my colleague Sarah Williams about these indictments.
So the indictment was handed down by a jury in Western Pennsylvania, where Westinghouse is located, one of the companies that was targeted by the Russian hackers. The indictment alleges that seven Russian military intelligence officers engaged in a multi-year conspiracy to hack several organizations, including anti-doping agencies, including the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, sporting federations, including FIFA, and an international chemicals watchdog.
It seems very wide-ranging, involving, as you said, both doping and chemical weapons.
That's right. Yeah, it basically involves two categories of organizations, as you said, anti-doping agencies and officials, and chemical weapons watchdog officials. And there are a couple of things noteworthy about the indictment. The one is that three of the seven Russian military intelligence officials indicted were also connected to the indictment that was handed down back in July by the special counsel's office in connection with the hacking of Democratic computers back in 2016. Now, the Assistant Attorney General Demers said today that this indictment did not arise out of the special counsel's investigation. Another noteworthy point about this investigation is that the Russians sent so-called close access or on-site teams to actual physical locations around the world, in Rio, for example, and The Hague, when an attempt to hack a computer system remotely was unsuccessful. So that's interesting. At least four of the seven agents that have been indicted were members of these so-called close access teams.
Well, altogether, this Russian operation and this investigation is very international in scope. You have the Netherlands, the UK, and Australia, as well as the US, that have raised accusations in this.
And Canada and Switzerland, actually. Switzerland, there's a chemical weapons lab in Switzerland that was testing, analyzing the chemical agent used in the poisoning of Sergei Skripal, who is another former GRU military intelligence officer. He was poisoned back in March. Now the British and the Dutch prime ministers issued a statement this morning condemning what they called unacceptable Russian cyber activity. This is nothing new. You know, Western intelligence officials have long known that Russia has and continues to engage in malicious cyber activity. But it's another major development that puts a spotlight on Russia's cyber activity.
That is VOA Justice Correspondent Masoud Farivar speaking with VOA Sarah Williams. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. First Lady Melania Trump goes to Africa. J. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Jennifer Cook, director of the Institute for African Studies at the George Washington University, talk about the First Lady's trip to Ghana, Malawi, Kenya, and Egypt, as well as the latest on U.S.-Sudanese relations. That's Encounter, Saturday and Sunday, on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Following a ruling by the International Criminal Court of Justice, the United States has announced it's terminating a 63-year-old treaty of amity with Iran after Tehran used the document to press its case against U.S. sanctions. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the decision to abrogate the treaty is 39 years overdue.
In July, Iran brought a meritless case in the International Court of Justice alleging violations of the Treaty of Amity. Iran seeks to challenge the United States' decision to cease participation in the Iran nuclear deal and to reimpose the sanctions that were lifted as a part of that deal. Iran is attempting to interfere with the sovereign rights of the United States to take lawful actions necessary to protect our national security. And Iran is abusing the ICJ for political and propaganda purposes. And their case, as you can see from the decision, lacked merit. Given Iran's history of terrorism, ballistic missile activity, and other malign behaviors, Iran's claims under the treaty are absurd. The court's ruling today was a defeat for Iran. It rightly rejected all of Iran's baseless requests. The court denied Iran's attempt to secure broad measures to interfere with U.S. sanctions and rightly noted Iran's history of noncompliance with its international obligations under the treaty non-proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Pompeo said existing exceptions by humanitarian-related transactions and safety of flight will remain in effect. He said the World Court has no jurisdiction to issue any order relating to the sanctions, which reflect U.S. national security interest. Indiana University scholar Hussein Banai tells VOA's Victor Beatty this represents a symbolic victory for Iran.
They were trying to demonstrate yet again that when it comes to international law, that they have the upper hand in the argument against the United States. And the United States was the country that was actually taking these actions or imposing the sanctions against the international consensus, but also against provisions in international law. So this was a very big symbolic victory for Iran. It doesn't mean that it would be abided by in practice, of course, as the American response indicates, but they have yet another data point in their case that the United States is the one that is acting against international law and not them.
Pompeo said the administration would proceed with sanctions enforcement with existing exemptions for humanitarian and flight safety transactions. So there are exemptions in these sanctions.
There are, but obviously the United States can always pull back and say Iran is exploiting them for other purposes. The United States can always come back, as they did in the case of Iraq, for instance, back when Saddam Hussein was still in charge, to allege that there are dual uses to certain products, such as spare parts for airplanes, for instance, that can be used for military purposes, or it would be used to strengthen the regime. So how much of this is actually going to pan out in practice, we have to see case by case.
Iran, when it opened the case back in July before the International Court of Justice, accused Washington of strangling its economy. Is that what's going on?
Well, it's very clear that the U.S. sanctions are having a profound effect already, and a big portion of the sanctions have not even gone into effect yet, the sanction against Iran's oil products that are scheduled to go into effect shortly. Iran's economy is absolutely reeling as a result of these decisions that really limit the activity of any international company, not just American company, but any international company that also does business with the United States to do business with Iran. So that has hurt Iran's economy, and it has hurt Iran's ability to cash in on some of the deals that it had signed with European and East Asian companies after the nuclear accord was signed. And so the United States action is absolutely responsible for the dire state of the Iranian economy at the moment.
On his Twitter account, following the ruling, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, praised the court, saying that it was another failure for sanctions-addicted U.S., victory for the rule of law. He said it was imperative for other countries to, quote, collectively counter malign U.S. unilateralism, and he accused the U.S. of being an outlaw regime.
It's very interesting how the tables have turned. It wasn't that long ago that then United Nations Ambassador Zarif would defend Iran's denunciations by international institutions and bodies, a sign of them kowtowing to American interests. And now he's kind of turned the tables, and obviously with some justification. I'm not sure this has anything beyond the symbolic value, as I said earlier, but they're going to maximize whatever advantage they can get out of this, especially when it comes to keeping the Europeans as part of the nuclear deal as partners, as defenders of Iran's interests against the United States.
As Indiana University scholar Hussein Banai speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
UN Refugee Agency warning populist politics and fear-mongering about immigration are eroding the international protection for refugees who are fleeing conflict and persecution. UNHCR Protection Chief spoke about growing protection concerns at the agency's annual refugee conference. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UN in Geneva.
Conflict, persecution, and violence have displaced a record 68.5 million people around the world. Most are internally displaced, while 25 million are refugees. These are people who have crossed international borders and are entitled to international protection under the 1951 Refugee Convention. But UN Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Volker Türk, says this right is slipping away. He says some governments are taking political and legal measures to narrow the concept of who is a refugee. He says being able to flee and be recognized as a refugee can be a matter of life and death. Unfortunately, he notes, the issue of security is too often used to adopt restrictive approaches to deny refugees protection.
Of course, there's no doubt governments need and must ensure the security of their citizens. But this is entirely complementary with providing refuge to people who flee persecution.
Turk says refugees are the victims, not the perpetrators of violence and terror. He says they often have rejected extremism and been targeted, forcing them to flee for their lives. He says it is unjust to deny security to people who need it most.
I think both in the global north and in the global south, I have to say, it's our observation, that the dehumanization of refugees, of migrants, of IDPs, of stateless individuals has become a worrying trend. It results from inappropriate language, misinformation, deterrence, arbitrary detention, separation of families and children, and warehousing.
Turk says xenophobia, racism, and bigotry often are driven by fear, anger, and anxiety within communities. He says they must be confronted and addressed. He warns history shows how the mistreatment of the foreigner paves the way for the mistreatment of the citizen. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Brazilians head to the polls on Sunday in the country's first round of presidential election, and unlikely, former military officer and longtime lawmaker Jair Bolsonaro of the Social Liberal Party seems to be in the pre-election polls at the top. Controversial 63-year-old Bolsonaro is an object of an assassination attempt that was just last month. He's viewed widely as controversial, even polarizing, in an outspoken law and order campaign. His chief rival is leftist Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad. Mark Jones is a political science professor at Rice University, where he chairs Latin American Studies. He tells VOA this is the most unusual election in Brazil since it returned to democracy in the 1980s.
The traditional parties have by and large collapsed, with the partial exception of the Workers' Party. And its ideal candidate, former President Lula da Silva, is in jail for corruption charges. And therefore, Fernando Haddad, former Sao Paulo mayor, is running in his place. On the other side, Jair Bolsonaro, he's been a congressman for quite some time, and he's seen as, at least traditionally, was seen as a very fringe actor. But in a country that's hungering for someone who's a non-traditional politician, who's not tied to elites, that is essentially an anti-system candidate, he's providing the vehicle for them to cast their vote. And right now he's ahead in the polls and seems certain to finish first on Sunday, although below the 50% plus one he would need to avoid a runoff. Right now we're looking at him and Fernando Haddad, the former mayor of Sao Paulo, who's the Workers' Party candidate, entering a runoff and then competing 3 weeks later to determine who will be the next president of Brazil for 4 years.
Jones said Bolsonaro's victory would represent a shift away from traditional party candidates in Brazil, which is South America's largest economy, toward the more populist candidates, much like what happened in Mexico, where they chose leftist president-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador. A second round of voting in Brazil, if necessary, will be held on October the 28th. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Over the years, astronomers have found several thousand exoplanets, or planets that exist outside of our solar system. Studying data gathered by the Kepler Space Telescope, the scientists came across a gas giant exoplanet called Kepler-1625b that exhibited irregularities suggesting an orbiting moon or exomoon. The astronomers followed up their Kepler studies with Hubble Space Telescope observations. These observations are providing initial evidence of a moon that is perhaps as big as Neptune orbiting Kepler-1625b, a planet several times more massive than Jupiter, and is located 8,000 light-years away in the constellation Cygnus. The astronomers stress that so far the existence of this exomoon is hypothetical, and more study is needed to actually prove its existence. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now it's time for a little something from the world of music.
I'll light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today. Staring at the fire for hours and hours while I listen to you play.
Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young is a folk rock group made up of American singer-songwriters David Crosby and Stephen Stills, English singer-songwriter Graham Nash, and Canadian singer-songwriter Neil Young. Song written by Graham Nash and recorded on their 1970 album Deja Vu. The song, an ode to countercultural domestic bliss, was written while Nash was living with singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell. My Country Tis of Thee, also known as America, is a patriotic song whose lyrics were written by Samuel Francis Smith with the same melody as the national anthem of the United Kingdom. David Crosby and Graham Nash have become known for their rendition of the song, which was one of the de facto national anthems of the United States before the adoption of the Star-Spangled Banner in 1931. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and all four members also inducted for their work in other groups. Crosby for the Byrds, Stills for Buffalo Springfield, Nash for the Hollies, and Young as a member of Buffalo Springfield. Southern Cross is a song written by Stephen Stills. The single was a success on the charts, reaching number 18 on the Billboard Hot 100, and many think of it as their signature song.
Got out of town on a boat going to Southern Islands, sailing to reach before a following sea. She was making for the trades on the outside and the downhill run to Papeete. Off the wind heading live the Marquesas. You got 80 feet of a water line. Nicely making way in a noisy bar in Avalon. I tried to call you, but on a midnight watch I realized why twice you ran away. Think about
how many times are using me, larger voices cry.
will.
Their collective abilities allowed Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young to straddle all genres of popular music, from country rock to confessional ballads, from acoustic guitars and voice to electric guitar and three-part harmony.
Because the truth you might be running from is so small, but it's as big as the promise of a coming day. So I'm sailing for tomorrow, my dreams are a-dying, and my love is an anchor tied to you,
tied with a silver chain.
I have my ship, and all her flags are a-flying. She is all that I have left,
and music is her name.
Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. By the way, the latest world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a great Friday. Now a bit more from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
This is Today in History. On October 6, 1539, Spanish conquistador Hernando de Soto and his army entered the Apalachee capital of Anhaika by force. Anhaika was located at the site of Tallahassee, that's the present-day capital of Florida. On this day in 1889 in Paris, the Moulin Rouge opened its doors to the public for the first time. It's known for its then-decadent can-can girls. In 1908, Austria-Hungary annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina from the Ottoman Empire. That action increased distrust among the governments in Europe and led to an arms buildup. This is believed to be a major step toward the World War that erupted 6 years later. In 1927, the movie The Jazz Singer opened. It was the first full-length film to feature the voices of its actors, marking the commercial rise of talkies and the decline of silent movies. On this day in 1976, Chinese Premier Hua Guofeng ordered the arrest of the notorious Gang of Four and their associates, thus ending the time of chaos known as the Cultural Revolution. In 1981, Egyptian President Anwar el-Sadat was assassinated at a military rally in Cairo. Sadat became a target for Islamic extremists after negotiating a peace treaty with Israel. In 2000, Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic resigned from office, admitting defeat in national elections the month before. Milosevic espoused a brand of Serb nationalism that led to military aggression against the country's neighbors. He was put on trial for war crimes, but died before the court reached its verdict. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
This is VOA News.